Hello, and welcome to Administrative Remedies, because you can't fix what you don't understand. Brought to you in part by the University of Tulsa College of Law. I'm Gwendolyn Savitz, an associate professor here at TU and the Associate Dean of Research and Intellectual Life.
And I'm Mark Rourke. I'm the Dean of the College of Law.
We'll be breaking down complex doctrines with real-life analogies and examples to demystify the world of administrative law for everyone trying to understand how government actually works.
Agencies are the main way the federal government gets things done. It's not through Congress, for reasons we'll be addressing over the course of this series.
We spent two episodes explaining why independent agencies exist and how they work. Now we're going to talk about whether the court will decide they are still constitutional.
That's a pretty big question.
It is. This case really isn't just about one commissioner at one agency. At stake are dozens of agencies, the Fed, the FCC, the SEC, the NLRB, asking whether any of them can continue to exist in their current form.
So what happened to get us here?
On Inauguration Day, Trump fires the FTC commissioner, Ms. Rebecca Slaughter. He didn't attempt to say there was a cause. It was just, nope, you're out.
But the last episode, we talked about Humphrey's executor and the 1935 case that said that Congress can protect the FTC commissioners from exactly that kind of removal.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? This is the exact agency that was at issue in Humphrey's executor. And yet, here we are. For 90 years, this precedent stood. This is what has formed one of the backbones of the administrative state. Presidents have grumbled about it, but it's been the law. Slaughter sued, saying that he didn't have the right to fire her. And under the statute, he doesn't have the right to fire her.
So the court's deciding whether Mark Humphreys has been right for 90 years or whether we've been living under a incorrect premise of administrative power.
Yes. Remember that Odysseus analogy from episode 6?
It's where Congress ties the president to the mast so he can't steer towards the sirens of short-term politics.
But Trump's argument here is that Congress is just not allowed to tie Odysseus to the mast. This forbids Congress from restraining the president in any way. And if he wins, all the ropes come off, potentially not just for the FTC, but again, for every independent agency.
All those agencies that we talked about, the architecture, the fixed terms, the bipartisan requirements, the for-cause removal protections, all of that would change.
Yes, all of it. So we're going to talk about both sides of the argument and then what the stakes are before we talk about what actually happened at oral argument.
So let's start with the basic facts. Who is Rebecca Kelly Slaughter?
She was an FTC commissioner. She was appointed by Trump in 2018. She was confirmed by the Senate and was serving a seven-year term that should have only expired in 2029.
Let's just say that again and remind ourselves. Trump appointed her during his first term in office back in 2018.
He did. And he was doing that because, as we talked about when we were talking about the independent agencies, the FTC is one where no more than three of the five commissioners can be from the same party. So the Democratic spot opened. He had to appoint a Democrat, and she is who he picked to fill that seat.
So the president can't just stack the commission with his own party.
Yes, he was following what the requirements were at that point.
But he's now seeking to fire her because he would rather have a new FTC that is aligned with his own party, but without any claim of cause.
He's trying to squarely set this up about as squarely as Humphreys itself was set up. On Inauguration Day, he fired both of the Democratic commissioners. She's the one challenging it. So the district court said she needed to be reinstated, which made a lot of sense. Humphrey's executor is still technically binding precedent until it's overturned. So they said that the government applying this binding law was unlikely to win.
And the Supreme Court then stepped in.
Yes, they granted certiorari before judgment, so they took the case before it had even finished at the appeals court. That's highly unusual.
It is.
And it signals that the court thinks this is urgent and important and that they fast-tracked it. I'll also note it probably means they didn't need to let the appeals court waste time on it because that was clearly not a precedent that was going to stand.
Okay, let's be charitable readers of this for a moment. What is Trump's best argument for why he thinks Humphreys was wrong?
He is pulling all of this from Article 2 of the Constitution. Can you read the vesting clause?
The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America.
Notice what it says there. The executive power, not some of it, all of it, and it needs to be vested in one person, the president.
So the argument is that if something is executive power, only the president can exercise it.
It goes beyond that. It's really that the president must be able to control anybody who's exercising executive power. Otherwise, it isn't totally vested in him. This is how the government's brief says it.
The president cannot take care that the laws be faithfully executed if he cannot oversee the officials responsible for executing them, and he cannot effectively oversee those officials without the power to remove them.
They are relying on the unitary executive theory. There's one executive, that's the president, and the president needs complete control. If you can't fire somebody, you can't control them.
So the president has to control everything because otherwise he doesn't really have power vested in him as the president.
Here, they're relying on Myers. They're taking it and running as far as they possibly can with it. So let's read a little bit of Myers.
That was Justice Taft's opinion in Myers, correct?
It was. Justice Taft, the former president.
The power of removal is incident to the power of appointment, not to the power of advising and consenting to appointment. And when the grant of the executive power is enforced by the express mandate to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, it emphasizes the necessity for including within the executive power as conferred the exclusive power of removal.
So he's using a lot of words there to say that removal is inherent to executive power. If the president appoints somebody to execute the laws, the president must be able to remove them.
But didn't Humphrey's executor come after Myers and then limit it?
It did. It did indeed. And Trump's argument is that Humphrey's was wrongly decided from the start, despite the fact that four of the justices from Myers were still around for Humphrey's and signed on to the majority. So here's how they're arguing it. They argue that Humphrey's invented this distinction that doesn't really exist between purely executive functions and quasi-legislative and quasi-judicial functions.
The idea that the FTC is somehow not really executive because it does rulemaking and adjudication.
Right. They're saying that this distinction is incoherent, and it certainly is an extraordinarily weak part of the opinion.
There is no such thing as quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial agency?
That is what they're arguing, that the FTC exercises executive powers when it investigates violations, when it brings enforcement actions, when it seeks penalties against private parties. It is executing the laws. That is the definition of executive power. There's no quasi-anything going on here. Next, they argue that this isn't even close. So do you remember Celia law, but I want to say Celia?
Yeah. It seems like there should be an extra vowel at the end of that.
It's really hard. They're also butchering it in oral arguments. So Celia law from last episode on the CFPB.
Where the court said a single director with for-cause protection was unconstitutional.
Yes. So Trump's lawyers say that Celia itself had already rejected the reasoning of Humphrey's executor. And the only question remaining was when the court would finally accept that and overrule it.
But what about stare decisis? I mean, 90 years of precedent has to count for something relating to Humphrey's executor, right?
In the past, it certainly would have. But Chevron was also a critical precedent that had been in place for decades. Here's what the government says in its brief.
Stare decisis does not require this court to adhere to a decision that was wrong the day it was decided and has only become more obviously wrong over time. Humphrey's executor rested on a distinction this court has repeatedly questioned, limited, and declined to extend. The time has come to overrule it.
What they're saying here is you overruled Chevron last term after 40 years. Humphrey's is older, sure, but it's also super wrong.
Let's think about the other side. What does Slaughter's side say about this power?
So they start with history, but they're going way further back in history than we did when we were talking about independent agencies. We generally think about it as starting maybe late 1800s, but Slaughter's side argues that this really goes back to the founding.
The founders created independent agencies, not just administrative authority like we read relating to Alexander Hamilton and the Treasury.
It really wasn't what we would say a modern regulatory agency is, but they did have some multi-member bodies with fixed terms and insulation from presidential removal. In 1790, Congress created the Sinking Fund Commission to try and manage the national debt. And the Sinking Fund Commission consisted of the vice president, the chief justice, and three cabinet secretaries. So this was a five-person group where the president couldn't automatically remove every member at will. although the president would have had control over the cabinet secretaries.
But seriously, the very first Congress did that.
Yes, they did. And that obviously included a lot of framers. So if the unitary executive theory was correct, why would they create a commission where the president couldn't fire all the members?
Were there others?
Yes. So starting in 1782, Congress created a series of commissioners to settle claims arising from the Revolutionary War. These commissioners also served fixed terms. They exercised significant discretion. They operated independently of presidential control. The framers were not unfamiliar with this idea.
So the argument is that the founders themselves used multi-member bodies with independent protections when they thought certain functions required them. But let's just be clear, that's nowhere in the constitutional text. The vesting clause does seem pretty clear.
It certainly vests executive power in the president, but it doesn't mention removal at all unless we're talking about impeachment. And we also talked about how this isn't an oversight.
In last episode, when we talked about the decision of 1789, when the first Congress debated the removal power.
And when they're doing that, they couldn't agree. This idea that obviously from the very beginning, they meant to have a president who had exclusive removal authority doesn't make sense.
They left it to Congress to structure the executive branch as circumstances would require. What about the multi-member structure specifically? Trump's lawyers seem to think that doesn't matter.
That is pretty critical. CELA law, the CFPB case, turns heavily on the fact that it only had a single director. And when writing it, Roberts emphasized that multi-member commissions were different. So let's just go back to this excerpt.
The CFPB's single director structure contravenes this carefully calibrated system by vesting significant governmental power in the hands of a single individual accountable to no one. With no colleagues to persuade and no boss or electorate looking over his shoulder, the director may dictate and enforce policy.
The court here was worried about one person with unchecked power. But the FTC had five commissioners, power was diffuse, no single person could dictate policy, and this bipartisan requirement always meant that the minority party at least had some representation.
So the structure itself is the check.
Yes, exactly. 33 former commissioners from various agencies also weighed in on the case, and their point was that these multi-member boards actually do foster deliberation, they require consensus building, they do prevent arbitrary decision making. No commissioner can act unilaterally. This really is a fundamentally different structure than a single director. And then there's stare decisis. 90 years is a lot. Congress has relied on this for decades. It has created dozens of independent agencies since 1935, and it's done that with the understanding that for-cause removal was constitutional. The SEC, the Federal Reserve Board, the NLRB, the FCC, the CFTC, the NRC, the FEC, all structured in reliance on Humphreys. Overruling it now wouldn't just change a constitutional quirk. It would destabilize the entire framework of federal regulation.
All those agencies we've talked about over the past two episodes, their structure depends on Humphreys being correct, which is what Sotomayor seems to allude to when she challenges the Solicitor General and says, you're basically destabilizing the basic structure of all governance.
Yes, that is what is really on the plate here.
Okay, something I've been wondering. Does every agency need the same level of independence, or is the Fed something different from the FTC, which might be something different from the NLRB?
People are trying to figure out how to save as many independent agencies as possible because it's clear that a lot of them are headed out. These tests are supposed to do some sort of balancing test, weighing the president's interest in control against Congress's reason for insulating particular functions.
So what would that look like?
Well, you can think of it like a hospital. You would treat a trauma case differently from a dermatology patient, and agencies do lots of different things. So it's possible the Constitution could treat some different things differently. They identified three tiers. First, agencies that primarily do adjudication, deciding individual cases, the Merit Systems Protection Board, for example, or the NLRB if it's resolving a labor dispute.
That's being court-like functions.
Yeah, they're acting like a court, and we've always understood that judicial independence is essential. We don't want to create a situation where the judge can be fired for ruling against the wrong party. And the Merit Systems Protection Board serves as a neutral adjudicator of federal employment disputes. Its entire function basically depends on the perception and reality of impartiality. If they can be removed for deciding cases in a way the president dislikes, they can't do this. That would mean that the president can fire somebody, even improperly. And then when they went to challenge it, the Merit Systems Protection Board would side with the president because otherwise they would lose their jobs. The next level, agencies that regulate markets where credibility and stability matter, like the Fed.
We talked in episode 6 about how the Fed needs to be insulated from election year pressure.
And the justices themselves also really want to protect the Fed. I would be shocked if the Fed were actually destroyed after this. They went out of their way to say they weren't addressing the Federal Reserve, that potentially it would be a fallback position, but they will carve out the Fed.
Is it too cynical to suggest that one reason that the justices might be so interested in protecting the Fed is that they have 401ks and investments in the stock market?
That would certainly be something somebody could say.
Well, what about the third tier?
Third tier. This is policymaking agencies like the FTC if it's doing rulemaking, or the FCC if it's setting telecommunications policy. The argument is that these functions might warrant less independence because they're more like traditional executive action.
So this might mean that the court is basically drawing lines. Some agencies get to keep their independence protections while others just don't.
It's possible they could do that. That's going to create some issues of its own, though. The FTC does rulemaking and adjudication. Same with the SEC and the NLRB. Most agencies do that. So how do you separate it?
You'd have to have different removal standards for the same person doing different things.
Yes. There are a lot of people arguing this really is all or nothing. Either Humphreys is right and we can have these multi-member boards, or Humphreys is wrong and the president needs to control everybody.
Okay. So let's get to brass tacks. What happens if Trump wins?
If Trump wins, because the court has completely overruled Humphrey's executor, he will have at-will removal power over every commissioner on every multi-member independent agency.
Immediately.
Immediately. The for-cause removal restrictions would be unconstitutional. The president would go through and fire everybody who was not in alignment with him politically.
What about the Federal Reserve?
That's where we keep hitting this problem. The court could theoretically issue a broad ruling saying that these removal restrictions are unconstitutional, including the Fed, but that seems really unlikely. They will almost certainly carve out some sort of exception so that the Fed can survive.
What would this mean, though, practically?
In CELA law, when they said that the removal restriction was unconstitutional, they solved it by just taking the removal restriction out. Rather than an independent agency, it just became an executive agency that the president had full control over. That is almost certainly what they would be doing in these cases, too.
This is basically Chevron flip-flopping, which we talked about before, except now actual human lives and mortgage rates are on the line.
Yes. So Chevron was about who got to say what a statute means, but this is about who gets to control the people making those decisions to begin with. And at least under Chevron, to really earn Chevron deference, agencies had to go through the notice and comment process, which took a long time. If you can fire commissioners and replace them overnight, you can shift policy instantaneously, and we would expect presidents to come in and clear house. One would expect those to start swinging wildly if the president has full control over the agency.
So what if Slaughter wins? And I think the question was raised by Justice Kavanaugh that couldn't Kelly just continue to receive her salary but be replaced on the commission?
So that was the second question they asked and the one they didn't really get to, which indicates it is likely she is not going to receive her position. But that was going to create incredible problems of its own. That was essentially a backdoor to removal, because then the president could go in and improperly fire everybody and just pay them off.
That seemed like a short shrift way of the president being able to get what he wants, but putting it at taxpayer expenses. Essentially, this is going to kick the can down the road again. We're going to see this come up. If Slaughter wins, this is not the end of this question.
No. But again, I would be shocked if Slaughter wins. That really, that doesn't seem like it's on the table. The question is just how narrowly the court decides.
We are going to break this episode into two episodes, since these are pretty dense. The next one will pick up as we begin talking about oral argument.
So that does it for today's episode on administrative remedies. Thank you for joining us today. Please, if you enjoy this podcast and enjoy this episode, give us a like on Spotify, iTunes, or whatever platform you're listening on. And be sure to tune in next time, where we'll continue to dive into the contours of administrative law. Because remember, You can't fix what you don't understand.